Welcome to Coin Flips and Controversies, an OrthoBullets original series dedicated to exploring gray zone decisions in orthopedic surgery.
This episode of Coin Flips and Controversies is sponsored by the IOE Unveil Arthroplasty Course, taking place January 12th to 14th, 2024 at the Height in Vail, Colorado. We hope you enjoy the episode.
This is a very casual and open format for this case that I'm going to discuss tonight. So I'll start off just by introducing the case to you. We'll go into some radiographs, and I'm just going to ask each of you some questions and get your thoughts. There's right answers and there's wrong answers, and I'll let you know if you give a wrong answer, as a matter of fact. So we'll make sure to cover all of those things. And as you mentioned earlier, if we're not happy with your answer, we'll just simply edit you out before we.
Bye, everybody. That's it.
We'll just edit you out if we don't like what you're saying. If you don't agree with what I did, I'm just going to edit you out of the webinar at the end. So, but this is an interesting case that presented to me last year. As a matter of fact, it's a 62-year-old female. And when she presented to me, she had actually had two prior revisions of her left total knee replacement. She had had her initial primary knee replacement done. And then she subsequently had a femoral revision. And then that was subsequently followed by a tibial revision. And we'll go through those x-rays. But when she presented to me, she was having really kind of weight-bearing pain. And she was to the point where she was requiring a use of a cane in order to ambulate. When she would get up and walk, and this is something that I'll kind of be curious to get your thoughts, you know, when I asked you about people's pain pattern, she had this gait kind of symptoms where when she first got up and walked and put weight on it, she had pain. If she walked a little bit longer, she kind of had this period of time where she felt like her knee maybe felt a little bit better. And then as she kept going, she had return of her pain. So that was her predominant symptom when she initially presented to me. And you can see here, she had her left total knee done in 2019. So these are all relatively rapid succession, interestingly enough. Relatively quickly, her femoral component loosened. And she had that revised in October of 2019. And then about a year later, had her tibia revised for what was deemed aseptic loosening. So just like I do for all of my painful total knees when I see them in the office, we worked her up for infection. So her sed rate was 4. At our place, less than 10 milligrams per liter is normal. I'm sorry, her sedimentation rate was 15. At our place, less than 30 is normal. Her CRP was less than 4 milligrams per liter. At our place, it's less than 10. And I did aspirate her knee. You can see the white blood cell count there. Less than 600, 77% neutrophils, and her cultures were negative. We'll come back to that in a minute because that generated some interesting chat on the OrthoBullets website when people were talking about what they might do with this case and how they would manage it. I did not test her for allergies. She came in with that test already done. I just want to be clear about that, but we can talk a little bit more about that as well. I suspect there may be some differing opinions, maybe not. And then, you know, these are my thoughts when I was looking at it. But let's move forward here and just, you know, to kind of get your thoughts. This was her exam. You know, so her knee looked relatively benign. She had neutral alignment. Her incision looked fine. I didn't feel like her knee was unstable, and she had good range of motion. You know, so if you're just examining her in isolation on the table, things along those lines, really pretty normal exam. You know, no instability, no malalignment, anything along those lines. So these were her initial films when she presented to me. And, you know, before we get to the radiographs, I just kind of want to get your, you know, thoughts. Maybe, Ann, I'll start with you. I talked to you a little bit about my preoperative workup for, you know, some of these painful knees and particularly some of these painful revision total knees. Anything that you're doing different when these patients are coming into your office, you know, painful total knee, kind of what's your go-to workup for these patients, if you will?
So I think a key point that was in your description was the fact that they had a period of pain-free, good function. Because I think, and I tell this to residents as well, that's a super important question to ask anytime you see a painful total knee, especially. Was it okay for a certain period of time and then got worse, or has it always been bad, right? Because unfortunately, there is a subset of patients who are unhappy with their total knees, and those are not people you want to be operating on if they have no other reason for revision besides some pain and you can't find anything else. Another thing that I think is helpful to find the there were actually indications for the previous revisions, right? Early loosening, not, you know, sometimes people come in, they've been revised, but nobody really knows why they were revised in the first place. So that's, again, another person you want to be careful of. Just thinking about your description, I assume there's no other relevant comorbidities because it wasn't included, but, you know, you think about something with multiple early revisions, negative cultures, are they immunosuppressed somehow? Is that part of it? And then in general, bone health workup, has somebody looked at bone density, things that may predispose for this early loosening? That's not necessarily going to change your surgical management, but it may help their recovery. So those were just some thoughts.
That's a good thought. I would say that's something that I probably don't think enough about. Can you give me a little bit of your kind of thoughts about, you know, pre-op evaluation, bone health, you know, even in the primary joint situation, how does that change how you may look at patients? Is that something that you're doing as a routine workup, or are there certain risk factors that may lead you to say, hey, I may need to look at their bone health a little bit closer?
So not necessarily routinely. It's more, you know, x-rays and vibes sometimes, you know. Do they come in and their x-rays left the, what do they call it, ghost bone, where they just the bone quality looks really bad. And maybe they have some risk factors, like they periodically on PO steroids, or they had a history of steroid use in the past that may predispose them to osteoporosis. I've never, especially if they have a severe arthritis, I haven't really had that delay the treatment, but I have that in the back of my head as something to mention to their primary care and refer. Oftentimes it's more, I go in and I know intraoperatively that the bone is poor quality. Maybe it's someone with a primary total hip that I cement, and I say, because they have the positive, I know this is getting off topic a little bit, but the positive Yankauer as canal finder test, right? And somewhat unexpectedly. And so those are someone I would cement the hip. And I've told patients, you know, please talk to your primary care doctor about your bone health. And most of the time they do result in diagnosis of osteoporosis and they can get on medication. So I know I sort of meandered a little bit there, but
no, that's good to know. I think it's an important topic that we tend to probably underemphasize in our treatment, right, of patients. And I think it's very, very important.
Another thing is, I don't routinely test for vitamin D unless someone I think is high risk for whatever reason. And again, I won't necessarily delay for it to normalize, but I'll, if it's low, I'll have them start like the 50,000 units weekly.
Yeah.
You know, for example, if they're post-bariatric, I'll be more likely to test for vitamin D and other nutritional markers and get them on that, but not necessarily delay the procedure, because I'm usually getting pre-op labs about four.
You know, it's amazing to me, because I went through a period of time and still do routinely test a lot of patients. And even here, you know, in the South where we have a lot of sunlight and a lot of exposure, well over half of my patients had some form, if not profound, at least moderate vitamin D deficiency. You know, that, and it's easily correctable, right? So that's something that we do screen for relatively routinely. I think we're also learning more about the immune health, right? The importance of vitamin D and immune health and things along those lines. So, Will Long, let me ask you a question. I mentioned that I routinely aspirate all my knees, all my painful total knees that I see, regardless of what their CR markers are. So in this case, she had a set rate in CRP. Is your thought process the same? From that perspective, are you aspirating all your knees in the office?
I would say it depends. I mean,
okay,
you know, it's easier to do a knee obviously than a hip, so we sort of approach the two somewhat differently. But if you know, I still do a history, I still do a clinical exam, and I think if you get baseline blood work that is as normal as yours, and there's no effusion. And they had no perioperative concern and they have no other joints of concern and they're not at a high risk, I think that's probably a lower yield issue. But I guess what I would say is I wouldn't fault anyone for routinely aspirating knees. Some office settings are a little easier to do that than others.
Sure. Okay. It makes sense. So I think your index of suspicion always plays a key role, and you know, I think even in potentially someone that's had numerous quick revisions, you might have a lower threshold to do it than, you know, in someone that didn't in that particular situation. So Michael Taunton, let me get your thoughts about these x-rays. So this is her, these are more or less her kind of immediate post revision of her tibia. So she'd already had her femur revised and then subsequently went back and had her tibia revised for loosening. So there's the AP view, there's the lateral. Nothing really much to see on her merchant view there, resurfaced patella. But give me a little bit about kind of your thoughts and your critique of this postoperative x-ray.
Yeah, so we can start all alignment. I think that's the first thing to do whenever you're reviewing any radiographs. You know, overall, looks like there's pretty neutral alignment. Neither implant is malpositioned in that plane. You can note that there's obvious distal augments on the femoral component and the tibial component. So there's been a fair amount of bone loss. You can see on the sagittal view that there's a minimal amount of slope on the tibia. It would appear that there's a pretty good restoration. You don't have the pre-op films, but there's a pretty good restoration of the posterior femoral condylar offset on that femur. You do have a cemented implant. This is a Biomet Vanguard revision system, not because the implant system really matters or companies matter. I don't have any disclosures related to it, but it's important to know the implant system, particularly in revision, so you know the particular ins and outs of it, what kind of constraint you may be able to have with that femoral or tibial component. But to the femur, you know, interestingly, it looks like that this is probably a press fit style stem that's been cemented into place. You can see a cement restrictor and a very dense cement envelope around the stem with a very large stem that's kind of filling the entire canal, which for a cemented stem, I, you know, typically don't feel like it's necessary to fill up the whole canal like that, but perhaps they were using that as a, maybe they were thinking about an uncemented stem and then decided to go ahead and go to a cemented stem. One of the important things to think about that is this particular stem diameter is larger than the connection to the femoral implant itself. So if you are extracting this, you're going to have more difficulty because you're going to be like a fist in a jar as far as the cement goes. That's something to be concerned about. You know, it does appear like the femoral implant's well fixed. The tibial component, again, you've got, 10 millimeters of probably tibial buildup there. It does look like you've elevated the joint line, maybe stretched it out. Cemented stem. Or a stem that's been cemented. I don't know if that's an uncemented stem or not, but it doesn't look like they were able to achieve really good interdigitation into the bone just on that initial radiograph. Not as much as you see on the femoral side.
Yeah, I think those are all, you know, great points about the stem diameter on the femur, the cement mantle, you know, that kind of geometric block that's been, you know, that's been created. But and I think your points about, you know, her posterior femoral condyle offset and things like that are important. And it goes along with her exam findings and the fact that she really didn't have an unstable knee. She had good range of motion. She didn't have any AP instability, you know, things along those lines. One of the things that came up quite a bit in the Ortho Bullets poll and in a lot of the discussions that was really great centered around this case. And if anybody who's listening has the opportunity to go back and look at this case and look at all the fantastic comments that were sent in about this, was, you know, people talked about making sure you look at the hip, what about the spine, you know, things along those lines. And I think part of that stems from, yes, out of necessity, we need to do that. And the other part of it, I think, stems from the fact there's some, a little bit of hesitancy to think about doing a big revision on this lady who's had three surgeries, two revisions in a relatively, short period of time. So from your perspective, do you routinely image the hip? Do you routinely look at the spine, or is that just more of an index of suspicion type of thing?
So spine is more of an index of suspicion, you know, based on exam findings. I get a long leg standing on all of my workups. So I'm getting a look at the hip and the full long alignment of the leg. You know, if there's something, if there's a tumor in the femur or something like that, I'm going to see that. So I think there is some aid in getting a long leg standing, if only just to reassure yourself about the hip and then be able to discuss about issues with alignment with the patient.
Okay, good. Yeah, I agree. I mean, we tend to have a very low threshold of doing it. These are her pre-op films. Again, just kind of gives me a free, you know, a free picture of the hip. Sometimes in this one, you're lucky you get a little bit of the lower spine image there, but I agree. My spine is purely based on kind of index of suspicion in my exam at the time of surgery, but I do like to avoid some of these surprises, either deformity, prior hardware, hip replacement maybe that I wasn't aware of, or on occasion pick up the, you know, the bad hip that could be, you know, referred pain in someone like this, particularly someone that's had, you know, this many revisions, things along those lines. So,
you know, we kind of talk about that as, you know, as a zebra, but, you know, it's something that I think all of us have seen multiple times in our practice. A revision knee comes in that's painful and they've got a terrible hip above. So it's really not just, you know, a wild fantasy. It's something we really see.
Yeah, I agree with Mike on that one. We actually see it quite a bit in New York. I think it's a little different with the tibia, Brian. I'd be interested to hear where she localized her pain. One of the interesting things I've found about knee component loosening is they can really tell you which component's loose if you ask them. So I get a little more concerned when it's a femur because they kind of grab their thigh. But with tibias, they're often very specific about where it's sore on that medial tibia and perhaps laterally if they've tilted into varus. But they often tell a very good story.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're right. That's why it's so important to kind of listen, you know, to what they're telling you, describing the character of the pain and where they feel it, things along those lines. So great point. All right, Anna, I'm gonna want you to, so these were her initial x-rays, you know, not too far after her revision that I was able to go back and get. And then these were when I initially saw her about a year ago. So wanted to kind of get your thoughts. I can toggle back and forth between, you know, these when I first saw her, what you're seeing there, and this one, which is her most recent one. And I wonder if you could kind of give me your thoughts about what you're seeing here over the course of about, you know, maybe 15 months or so, you know, maybe 16, 18 months or so since those x-rays and when she presented to me. What are your thoughts about these x-rays?
Yeah, so I think you see that nice white out in the femur like before. I don't see many changes. If you look at the tibia, I'm concerned more about that medial side lucency. That seems to be new. I don't know if you want to keep going back and forth, but that seems new to me compared to the previous.
Yeah.
I'll give you that specifically. In the new one, I think you see now more defined lucency around there. So that would already, and then distally as well. So potentially now we're thinking is something wrong with the tibia at this point.
Yeah. And let me show you her lateral, you know, here as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think you're right. You can really start to see in my mind kind of some demarcation, right, developing, especially kind of up in that metaphyseal area, if you will, right? Like kind of right along this area. I don't know if y'all can see my pointer or not, but kind of in that proximal metaphysis on the medial side, and then on this x-ray, really on that posterior side, really on that posterior side as well. So let me jump forward here with a couple of these x-rays, and I'm gonna come back to that in a minute. Into that last question here, but I wanted to get, these are some of the poles. I picked out four of the poles that I thought were most interesting and most relative to the case, and we can kind of get the panel's thoughts about this. So we have AP and lateral radiographs of this case. We have the films from her immediate posterior revision. We have the most recent films. From your perspective, Anna, we'll start with you, and then we'll just go down the line. Any other imaging at this point that you would obtain routinely in this patient?
I mean, we have the long legs, we have the merchant, like Do we have a merchant for this one? So I would get merchant.
We did. Right. Yeah, we did have a merchant for this one.
If we have a merchant view and we have long leg films for her, which we do, and I'm clinically not concerned about patellar maltracking, which it doesn't sound like we are for her, I don't think we need any other. Personally, I wouldn't get any other imaging at this point. You did show the bone scan briefly. I think that's, yeah. I hate bone scans usually, but in this case, I don't think it's wrong to cover yourself and reassure. I probably would as well. But if we're looking based on here, these questions like CT, MRI, I think the x-rays are fine. I don't know what else.
Okay, good. Yeah, no, I think that's important. Will, any thoughts about any additional imaging? You know, you're very fortunate where you practice at HSS to have all kinds of fancy different imaging and all kinds of fancy people that can read them way better than anybody at our places can. So anything that you all are doing differently to look at these?
Yeah. So I think the question you have to ask yourself is, what's your pretest probability and plan?
Yeah.
So the thing we often do is we just, and you hear it all the time in grand rounds, is I do this test and this test. I'd look at the quality of the bone with the CT scan. Well, how's that going to change what you're going to do? So I'm much more conservative, probably my Canadian roots. I will say that some of these fancy MRIs can provide you with a number of different insights in terms of loosening, as well as the synovium, the soft tissue about the knee. So they've become more helpful in looking for low-grade infection, synovitis, those sorts of things. So I think there are additional modalities that in specific cases you can get from an MRI. But with your current radiographs and progressive changes, this would not be a case where I'd seek additional imaging.
Okay, good to know. Michael Taunton, anything different on your end? Any additional imaging that you might get?
No, I would get x-rays. I would get all of these exact x-rays. I will occasionally get a bone scan, kind of like a lamppost, more for support than
examination. I like that.
Because that's, you know, you can tell the patient, oh, see this black line, you know, this means it's loose. You know, it's pretty hard for them to detect. I think if you show them that bone scan and say, look how your femur looks. Now look how your tibia looks. These are little white blood cells that are going to that area and trying to heal something that can't heal. The patients understand that. So yeah. I think that gives them a little bit of confidence that you know what you're talking about and that you're going to help them. You know, I think there's some psychology involved in revision total joints.
Totally. And you hit the nail on the head. And I think two points to bring up about that. One is, you know, Will Long, your comment about how is it going to help you? How is it going to change what you do? I mean, you're right. You can order CT scan, MRI, things along those lines. But is it fundamentally going to change how you approach the case and what you may do operatively? And I'm in agreement with the Reds panel. I rarely get bone scans. I'm not as passionate as Anna saying I hate bone scans. I'm a little more sensitive than that. I do get them on a rare occasion, but this, Michael, to your point, this was kind of one of those psychological tests, both for me and the patient, to be completely honest with you, because here she was having had two prior revisions. None of them seemed to work great. You know, this is a patient that when I saw her the first time in the office, I didn't sign her up for surgery right away. You know, I said, hey, you know, you've been through a lot. This is something that I'm suspicious about, but I think we need a little bit more time to kind of look at this. And I think I saw her back probably two or three more times in the office before I actually made the decision to operate on her so I could get to know her a little bit more, so I could continue to study her x-rays. And I think it was on that second visit that I ordered the bone scan. And it was more for me just kind of a confirmatory test that I was barking up the right tree, so to speak, if you will, that, you know, then I could say, okay, your clinical symptoms make sense, your x-rays make sense. I'm still a little bit hesitant to convince myself and you that going to this next step of having a third revision on this knee was the right thing to do. And then obviously you could see from that, you know, from that scan that, that, you know, there was increase, you know, tracer in that area, increase uptake in that area. I'm going to try and get back to the bone scan here. So excuse me just a second. if I'm kind of losing my toggle ability here for some reason.
Well, while you're toggling, you could also argue, to go back to argue with myself about bone scans. Let's say your aspiration results were less definitive, more equivocal. Maybe the bone scan, like a tagged white cell scan, could add another tool, another data point to look for infection versus loosening potentially.
Yeah.
You could argue that as well.
But how about on the flip side? I'm sure all of us have had a patient go to another provider and get an early bone scan after a joint replacement that's elevated and been told that it was loose when it wasn't. So you've had a revision done at the end of 2020. You're kind of still in that 18-month phase where
great point.
Theoretically could see a little light up on that tibial side that may be asymmetric with your femur, which was revised a year earlier. So It can be a bit of a challenge sometimes.
You're right. But it's a great point. I think you're right. The temporal relationship of when you get the scan is important. And, you know, in my practice, most of the time when I get a scan, I'm praying that it's negative, right? Because it's kind of one of those situations where you see the patient, nothing's wrong with them. X-rays look normal. Exam is fine. They hurt. You say, all right, I'm going to get this test, and you hope it's negative. So you can say, see, there's really nothing wrong. You know, there's really nothing wrong with you. This case was a little bit different, but that's typically how I approach, you know, the utilization of those scans. So
and that's why I said support, you know, not so much illumination, because looking at the radiographs, you know, we've looked at the percentage based system. You know, we looked back at aseptic loosening of tibias. Greater than 25% of a radiolucent line around a tibia is, you know, almost always loose. So, I mean, we've got more than 50% radiolucent line around this tibial component. I think, you know, the radiographs are telling you and I this tibia is loose, along with her clinical, you know, syndrome.
Great point. So use your clinical judgment and the tools that you have. Don't just rely always on the technology. And, you know, speaking of technology, I pulled this question in as well, because this generated a lot of discussion on ortho bullets as well, which is, you know, we talked about aspiration. Some would do it, some wouldn't. I do it routinely. I thought it was helpful because of her multiple surgeries, but there's a lot of interest and utilization of some of these molecular, you know, techniques, whether it's PCR, you know, DNA sequencing, other molecular biomarkers, things along those lines. And I thought it was a good discussion point, maybe to ask the faculty, if you're routinely using any of these tests beyond just our standard head rate CRP and, you know, synovial white blood cell count percent differential cultures, and when you might go to something different. So let's get all three of the panel's thoughts about this. Will, maybe I'll start with you and see when you're using anything that's kind of outside of what we would consider the standard testing.
Yeah. So the short answer is I'm not. It took a long time for some of these to come into New York. You couldn't send things away at our center. So we kind of got used to just doing the standard routine. And then when I looked at some of the stuff that came out of the, you know, international consensus, it seemed as if the existing markers were equivalent or similar in terms of outcomes to the more advanced markers that were being done. As far as the more advanced sequencing, I think there are some concerns, and that's still under development and consideration at our shop. Alberto's certainly done some work on it, but I think there's a little ways to go on that. So my short answer is I'm just doing the routine standard that you did.
Okay.
And it's really uncommon to get, you know, although we always talk about it, such, you know, so many things don't go together, right? I mean, to have a benign appearance, to not have concerns with infection, to not have an effusion, you know, to see one thing elevated is rather unusual. We discuss it a lot, and yet we don't seem to see it that commonly.
Okay, great. Anna, thoughts, anything different routinely in your practice that you're utilizing at this point?
So just alpha defensin, but not all the time. In this patient, okay, I will say in this specific situation where you have multiple early revisions, even, you know, I normally don't even aspirate unless the markers are elevated. Now they only have to be a little bit elevated, but if the markers are stone cold normal in, you know, painful total knee, I usually do not aspirate. In this specific patient with multiple revision, even with normal markers, I would aspirate because it's just a weird picture. And you're concerned for something indolent, maybe, I don't know. And in this patient, I would aspirate and I would probably send for the alpha defensive. Just as again, I like the lamppost, right? Another support.
Yeah, sure.
And then if I'm concerned, you know, if that's all negative, you know, I think instead of these other fancy synovial fluid tests, I would just go, when I revise it, send a bunch of tissue cultures and likely keep them on, you know, 24 hours of IV antibiotics and then transition to orals and then wait for those cultures to come back so that if something does show up positive, which I think the tissue is probably more reliable than the synovial fluid, then they're good covered point. While you figure out what that is. That's
yeah, nice. I like that. Yeah. And that was a lot of the discussion that was kind of going back and forth on ortho bullets about, you know, it's a little bit of an unusual case, you know, early failure, femoral component, tibial component. Is it possible there could be something indolent, you know, going on here that maybe your routine tests don't pick up? So Michael, does that change your thought process about what you're routinely using to work up these patients?
So, you know, we looked at, you know, looking at seronegative infections, you know, sed rate and CRP are normal, and we still found infections about 4% of the time.
Okay.
So that's led me, I aspirate every knee. I get a sed rate and CRP on every knee. And then on the aspiration, I think the cell count and differential and the culture are the real key things. I think that's going to pick up that small, very small group that your sed rate and CRP are normal, but despite that, you still have an infection present. And this is certainly one of these situations that you know, that might occur. I do get alpha defensin, which is done here in house, and a PCR that's done here in house on every patient. And, you know, admittedly, I think that's more for academic pursuit because, you know, I would say it's a rarity that is going to, you know, become involved in a clinical decision. Now, some situation where you really have, you know, some, you know, negative culture, but all the labs are really concerning. I'm thinking about resecting and then the alpha defensin comes back positive, you know, then we have it, you know, it can be serve as a tiebreaker for me. But, you know, honestly, the PCR, I really haven't found all that useful. But, you know, again, from a research perspective, it's something we continue to do.
Okay. And I think that, you know, obviously we need site like yours that are continuing to look at this and gather more information, more data. And I think that, you know, in these kind of tricky situations, I don't think you can ever be faulted for getting a little bit more information. And that's, you know, kind of what our poll says here. There's about 40% of, you know, the respondents that said they would get, you know, an alpha defensin or a synovature test. And still about, you know, 27% of patients that said they, you know, they would just do our routine, you know, work up small percentage that are looking at the microgen DNA, microgen DX, or a combination of the two. So I think that really kind of falls in line with, you know, with what we've been talking about. So here I think is a lot of the crux of this, you know, discussion with this patient, which is how you all going to approach this from a revision, you know, perspective. And, you know, I might frame the question of, well, I'll pose this to you. Let's just say, for sake of discussion, and just someone that has primary components in a routine revision, let's just say aseptic loosening of the tibia, but the femur's fine, but it's a primary femur, not a revision, you know, femur. Are you, what are your thoughts about tibial only revisions versus femoral and tibial, you know, revisions? How do you approach that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there are a number of issues you want to look at. I think, you know, simply retaining the femur becomes an exposure issue in some cases. So if this lady had a stiff knee with a patella baja with limited range of motion, it might be part of what I needed to do just to expose the knee and get at the tibia. I think you run into matching issues. So some components may be really old or don't exist, or I don't have access to, or I don't like using. So those, you know, I may not be familiar with it. And I think the third thing is the options that exist with that. So if I want a more constrained polyethylene and that sort of thing, or I want a specific type of cone or stem that doesn't exist with that femoral side, then that's an issue. I would put in the fourth thing, which is that I think we lump all of our revisions together. So I think when we look at single component revisions not doing as well, and if we broke them down by a single component revision for instance, stiffness or instability, I think we would be more likely to have a re-revision than in this case where we're focusing on a identified concern with one specific component that we can address effectively on that one side. So a lot of stuff to talk about, but that's sort of my thought process in focusing. In this case, I would just address the tibia.
Yeah, I think those are all great points. I think, you know, Arlen Hansen, who we all know, he was a mentor to some extent to all of us, used to say he used to take out all the components because if he ever left one and was forced to use a system that he didn't like, he likened it to like playing a round of golf with rented golf clubs. They were okay, but it's not as good as the ones that you normally use. So he had a pretty low threshold for revising all the components. But, you know, I think I'm going to go back to the x-rays here. I think this is, you know, this poses some challenges if you're talking about taking everything out, and it poses some challenges if you're going to leave everything in. So, Anna, maybe talk to me a little bit about we'll get to how we addressed it here in a little bit, but just talk me through a little bit about any chance you're taking that femur out. Are you prepared to take it out? And is there any reason that you might want to take it out right from the beginning?
It seems beastly to remove.
Yes, it's a good description.
And if you're fairly certain it's not infected, I think it's all about exposure, right? Of course you want to be prepared to do anything. I mean, I live my life motivated mostly by fear. So I don't want to be caught unprepared to do something. So I would have the extraction stuff available and the revision femoral stuff there. But the concern would be, you know, try to retain it, and then you have to get a really nice wide exposure so you can bring that tibia forward. I mean, luckily, I mean, if it's loose, you have all that bone loss. I mean, there's not going to be much tibia. You know, you should be able to bring it forward and see what you need to do, I think, as long as you're careful about it and slow. And that would be a case where, you know, I'd be like cell by cell getting the scar out, but gradually bringing it forward, going back to my point of living in fear. But maybe that's something you all can give me pointers on, how to like dive into a revision knee quickly. But I tend to do these really slow, peel everything slowly, and then just gradually get behind that tibia to bring it forward.
Yeah, I think you're right. You bring up a couple good points. And there's a couple things that, you know, obviously I'd love to have the exposure taking the femur out, but that's a well-fixed femur. As you said, it's beastly. Mike Taunton brought up the issue earlier about the geometric block on the femur. The other things that, from my perspective, I think that were helpful is, number one, she had really good range of motion. So she was 0 to 120. So it's a little different if you're doing that than if you're dealing with a knee that's say 0 to 45. And two, she had good stability, right? So sometimes I feel like if I'm dealing with knees that are very unstable or they have a flexion extension mismatch, sometimes that can be challenging to deal with just on the tibial side because you lose that independent control of your flexion extension gaps. But she had good range of motion and she didn't have any instability. So that made me feel a little bit more comfortable about being able to do that just from the tibial side. And Michael Taunton, I don't know if you have anything else to add, you know, extensile exposures, you know, low thresholds for other types of exposures when you're thinking about just doing the tibia.
No, that's why I was kind of going back to the preoperative exam, and you just alluded to that. The range of motion was good. If you've got a 20 degree flexion contracture and a slightly loose flexion space, you know, managing the flexion extension gap is going to be one of the important concepts when thinking about whether to go to the femur or not. And then in this case, the femur is obviously not loose at this point, and you have a significant penalty if you decide to take that implant out. You, speaking of extensive exposures, you might be looking at some sort of osteotomy of the anterior cortex of the distal femur to try to burr at that cement because it is well fixed. I think, you know, in usual situations, I would say, geez, you know, we've had loosening a couple of times. I'm not really happy with the technique that was utilized here. I'm going to go ahead and take out the femur. In this case, I think there's a significant penalty into saying, I'm going to go ahead and take out this femur. So I would actually rather take the chance of this femur failing in 5 years and then it being easy to take out than destroying a femur and possibly ending up with a hinge or something worse trying to get this femur out. Extensile exposures, maybe we'll talk to a little bit longer, but you know, with good range of motion, typically starting by opening up the medial lateral gutters, mobilizing the knee, you're going to be able to get that exposure that you need, particularly with the amount of tibial bone loss that we see here.
Yeah, I think the great points. I think it's always nice to have those in your back pocket, whether it's, you know, I think majority of times, especially in these knees with good range of motion, you know, synovectomy, free up the gutters, low threshold for a quad snip, but it's always good to be, you know, prepared for some of those. And so you can see here, you know, the audience, you know, response poll, just over half said tibia alone. I've decided the next time we do one of these, this kind of reminds me of, you know, when you're watching your favorite college football team, you know, play, and it comes down to the end of the game, and they, you know, they trot out in the field to kick a 25-yard field goal to win the game, and they miss it. And people start writing in all these tweets and comments, how can you miss that? I could do that in my sleep. And I don't know if you've seen this now, but they actually bring some of those people into the audience and they have them on live TV and they make them try and kick a 25-yard field goal with no line in front of them or anything. And invariably, everybody, you know, messes it up or shanks it or, you know, anything like that. So I think next time we're going to invite these 95 people on who want to pull out that femur and allow them to kind of go through the process of how they're going to go about doing that. So maybe they meant they're just prepared to do both, but boy, I'll tell you, you know, Anna, to your comment about living in fear, taking that femur out is not something that I would routinely do, you know, 31% of the time, my mind, you know, jumping into this. So nevertheless, it's good to see a little variety.
Well, I mean, definitely, I guess we want to underscore that we don't want people going into this kind of case without the ability to
absolutely
revise the femur, you know.
Absolutely.
I think planning on revising the femur is a very probably not great idea, but being prepared to is a very good idea.
Very good. Okay, so I think this is kind of the crux of the discussion here. So we talked about infection, we talked about the workup. I think we all agree from the radiographs that we have and the patient's clinical exam, we feel pretty confident that this is a loose tibia, early loosening of the tibia. And so here's a bunch of different options that were listed in the Ortho Bullets, you know, poll here, and we'll come back and touch on, you know, each on some of these options and kind of what your preferences are. But let's go back to the X-rays here, the case, so we can just talk a little bit about, you know, what those options may be. But maybe you wanted to get the panel's thoughts about why this may have happened. Why are we looking at within, you know, 18 months of a tibial revision with a decent length cemented stem? Why are we seeing this loosen relatively quickly? So, Will, do you want to give maybe your thoughts about kind of the underlying etiology of this from a mechanical perspective? We know it's not, you know, we know it's not infectious or anything along those lines. So maybe how you look at how this was revised initially and how that plays into your thoughts about how you're going to tackle it in the revision setting.
Yeah, and I think that's probably really the crux of the discussion, right? I mean, that's when you're going to go in there and revise it, you got to know why it failed. Otherwise, I can almost guarantee you'll be back the same way, you know, soon. So, you know, when I look at it, I try to determine, so their alignment, you know, you can be concerned about being in varus. I think they achieved a fairly neutral alignment here without, you know, running a ruler down the tibia and the overall HKA, but looks reasonable. And then it comes down to primary fixation. So did they achieve stable primary initial fixation? And I think we would argue they probably didn't. That radiolucent line came up fairly early. And secondly, did they obtain any form of biologic fixation in addition to the primary fixation? So they didn't select any type of cone or sleeve or anything that would get you an additional layer of fixation. Ferris Haddad has discussed, and a number of other colleagues, Andrea Baldini, you know, the zonal fixation that we all, anyone who's done revisions for a while sort of has in the back of their mind. But on the tibial side, that's, you know, do you have a good flat surface? Do you have a good metaphyseal area of fixation? And do you have a good diaphyseal fixation? So if we did it in that manner, you know, you've got an augment here that eliminates your keels and really sort of doesn't sit well on the proximal tibia. You've got failure of metaphyseal fixation. You really don't have anything achieving fixation in that zone. And then you just don't have good fixation down in the diaphysis. So try and avoid doing that again. And that would lead me to what I would do.
Yeah, I think that's, I think you hit all the highlights there. That's so, you know, critical about, you know, you have this tibial component that has these probably 10 millimeter augments on there, no keel. So it takes out all the rotational, you know, control out of this. So essentially this thing is basically just sitting on this cemented stem with nothing in the metaphysis down into the diaphyseal area. We probably know because this is, she's already had a revision that metaphyseal bone, particularly in that central region, was not great, which is why to the comments that were made earlier, they didn't really get a lot of great cement interdigitation into this metaphyseal, you know, region at all. But this was, you know, I would argue this was the historical way that we dealt with these revisions for a long period of time, unless we were going a lot longer, you know, with our stems all the way down here into the diaphysis, which kind of brings up my next point, my next question, Anna, I'll ask you as far as preference for stem fixation. And you can just say in general on the tibia in revisions, and maybe in particular as it relates to this case. Is this something where you're looking down below the cement mantle all the way down into this diaphysis thinking, okay, I got to get down there now to be able to get some fixation?
So in general, I'm a cones plus short cemented stem gal. Like that's my sort of go-to revision construct. This case I think is different for a variety of reasons. First of all, I mean, getting the some sort of biologic fixation, yes, but you see, they've already done a longer cemented stem, so I don't think I would go back and do a shorter cemented stem for this one. And what is that quote, like, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and expecting a different result? So I'd want to do something different. So the one different thing would be the biologic fixation proximally and like cone versus sleeve, whatever you prefer. And then distally, even though I'm normally short cemented stem, for this one, maybe consider either like longer diaphyseal sort of a press fit if you can bypass that and get all that cement out, which seems also annoying. Or as again, as suggested in the poll questions, some sort of attempting to like improve that interdigitation and bone quality with your impaction grafting. But you have to do something different. You can't just try and do the same thing again, because I didn't see what the first revision was, but I assume it was maybe similar.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a good point. I mean, I think that we've all have evolved to and very much trust this biologic fixation in the metaphysis, whether or not it's with a cone or a sleeve. But you're right, just going down further in the diaphysis with either a longer cemented stem or a long press fit stem when you're not getting any support in that zone one and zone two, I think is ultimately going to be doomed to fail in this case, you know, as well. Michael Ton, any different thoughts about, you know, if we go through and kind of look at our options again, you know, here as far as, you know, options for fixation on the tibial side? I know obviously you all have had a broad experience with different types of fixation, but what's your approach to this now in 2023?
Yeah, I think a lot of these revision settings, you know, we see implants like this, as you were discussing. It's a large tibial augment, The keel has gone away secondary to that large augment, so you've lost your rotational stability. They probably didn't get much through a sclerotic rim because it was probably already reamed up pretty big. Whatever cancellous bone may have been there, it would appear they probably reamed it out during the preparation. So you're probably left with a situation that there was only cancellous bone in that small segment of metaphysis. So unfortunately this was probably doomed to fail. I think getting that rotational stability now in 2023 is the biologic fixation of a cone or a sleeve. Here we've been talking about impaction bone grafting and short cemented stems. I probably, if I was doing a cemented stem, I probably wouldn't worry about going any longer than that one if I was doing impaction bone grafting with a cone. But I think, depending on your training and your preferences, I think you could choose to do a diaphyseal engaging cementless stem in this situation, as long as that stem was either mated to a sleeve or rigidly fixed with cement to a cone proximally. And there's good techniques and ways to do that. I would actually say there's, you can delete this from the webinar as you threatened earlier, Brian. But I think there's two answers. I think answer 5 and answer 9 are both good. I would just, the one thing I would counter is that if you're doing a cemented stem, I don't really think you have to go real long. I think doing a cone and bone grafting, I don't typically go really long with those. I'm regularly doing 100 millimeters.
Okay, fair enough. I think you're right, and I think again you're right. The stem fixation I really think depends on on your preference, but we all agree the key is that metaphyseal fixation. And if I ask the panel, maybe just real quickly, in your revision knee settings on the tibial side, what percentage of the time are you using either a cone or a sleeve, depending on the system that you use? Will?
Yeah, I've gone through probably, I'd be interested in everyone else, but an evolution over time, right? So we got access to the cone, so I put them in everyone. And then I started to find knees where, you're doing a revision and it's maybe some poly wear or something, but or for instability, and there's just not a lot of bone loss there. I didn't feel like I needed it. So in those cases, when they didn't have a lot of bone loss, I'd actually put a cemented stem with a restrictor. Mm-hmm. And now I've sort of come back to putting in more cones. So I actually look at the diagnosis. So if you have an aseptic loosening of the tibia, you 100% get a cone in my hands. And we've done some finite element analysis on this, looking at the medial tibial offloading afforded by that cone, and it's tremendous. Whether or not you cement or uncement your stem, it really does give you an incredible amount of support in that region. So I do mostly cones now, but in some cases I won't. I don't do them at 100%, maybe 80.
Okay. All right. And a percent of your tibial revisions that get some sort of metaphyseal fixation?
Yeah, pretty much all cones all the time. I'm trying to think back. There was one, I don't know if this counts as revision. It was a conversion uni with a ton of femoral bone loss, which is weird in itself. Infection negative, got in there. There wasn't really much in the tibia, right? But I took everything out. And when I converted that, we did, augments on the femur and a stem, and then the tibia was just, convert to a total with a short stem. So I didn't add anything there, but then I've done uni conversions that required cones. So I'm putting in cones. Maybe I'll eventually get an evolution of my own, but for now I'm sticking with mostly. It's tough though, because you're going in there sometimes and you're reaming that out, and it's like, ooh, that's some good bone there that I'm taking.
Right. I feel that. Yeah. And I'm the same. I do them almost probably 100% of all my tibias. And, fortunately now with the variety and shapes and sizes, we can be a little bit more bone conserving, but you, in certain situations, you do maybe take a slightly more bone than what you want to. Michael, Tony, anything different?
No, I'm just going to say 100%. And you know, the first revision is the most important revision.
Yeah.
So metaphyseal fixation on every tibia and a lot of femurs. I wouldn't say I'm not 100% on the femur. You know, if I'm revising a CR femur and you know you're cutting back to a brand new looking femur, I you know sometimes won't use a cone there. But even if I have aseptic loosening on a tibial component on a uni, that's going to get a cone for sure. You know, if it's progression of arthritis, maybe not. But I would say so. You know, pretty much every revision.
Okay, good. And that's, you know, I think that message I think is getting out. If I look at this poll and just isolate the ones that have, you know, plus a cone or sleeve, plus a cone or sleeve, you know, plus a cone or sleeve, we're getting up above, you know, 50% or so of the respondents that, you know, are putting at least, are putting a metaphyseal, you know, device, you know, in there, with, you know, lower percentage of people just talking about press-fit alone or cement alone. So, you know, I think that's encouraging. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, kind of where we were. So we get in there and, you know, this is kind of one of those things where you're like, oh, great. All the cement came out, attached onto the stem, and none was left down the canal, right? Exactly what, you know, we saw from the x-rays, that radiolucent line around the cement, you know, bone interface. So exposure was relatively straightforward because, again, as we talked about, she had good range of motion. I didn't have to use anything extensile. You know, a couple taps axially on this tibia, freed it up underneath the surface with a small saw, a couple taps, and the whole thing just, you know, popped out. And you can, as I think maybe Michael, the words that you used, you could see that this was just kind of doomed to fail, right? I mean, just that fixation surface, no keel, right? Very little interdigitation into that kind of poor bone, you know, in the metaphysis. So, you know, this is maybe where we were a little bit controversial, and this was partly because of the system and the options, you know, that I had. So they either had one that was shorter and one that was relatively longer. It did end up going a little bit shorter than this, but this was just kind of get a little bit of perspective about where we wanted to be with our stem length. And I too, Anna, just like you mentioned, and, you know, Will, and actually all of us have really migrated towards, you know, metaphyseal fixation and short cemented stems. And even in a lot of my straightforward revisions, I'll do a little 50, you know, stem, but in something like this, I was going more for the kind of 75 to 100, you know, millimeter length, you know, range here. And then I still like to get intraoperative x-rays with all my components in. But what I really wanted to, you know, focus on here is obviously you can see the metaphyseal fixation with the cone that's there. But, you know, something, Michael, that I learned from, you know, from your colleagues at Mayo, and something that I've started to do more routinely now, is this concept of impaction grafting, right? We've heard about a lot on the femoral side in revision hips. There have been some good recent articles. I know the Mayo group has recently, you know, presented this at some of the meetings on the success of this impaction, you know, grafting. But wanted to get, you know, the panel's thoughts about, is this something that you've done? I'll be honest with you, for me, it's been something really in probably the past, you know, 12 to 18 months that I've been using it a little bit more routinely. Once I saw some of the techniques, some of the refinement of the techniques, my, again, love for kind of shorter cemented stems and metaphyseal fixation, I thought this was a good way to, you know, to be able to address this problem. So, Will, maybe we'll start with you and kind of, you know, get your thoughts on this, if you've had any experience about doing this, and you know, maybe do you think this is a good case or good indication for it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the technique and the way you've presented it look great. It's not something that I do routinely. In this case, I'd have actually done a hybrid uncemented stem, so I'd have got very good fixation in the diaphysis. You're right, probably a 110 millimeter stem, and then, you know, had the cone and mated them with metaphyseal cement fixation. But you know, I think the one thing that, you know, is, are you getting good primary initial fixation, particularly in a multiply instrumented canal? But I think you've done a great job here. And I think if you get that good interdigitation like we've seen for years on those femoral stems, I think it's a great technique.
Okay. And what are your thoughts? Any experience with doing this or any thoughts about the, you know, the concept surrounding it?
I think it's cool. I heard someone describe it as it shouldn't work, but it does. No, and I think that's what's awesome about impaction grafting. But no, I mean, I don't have a ton of experience with it in practice, but if, I mean, seeing this case, you know, it's something that if I have the right indications for it, I think it could be a cool thing to try. And, you know, being very wary, going back to living in fear of fracture. I mean, what did you do intraoperatively to try to, I mean, you had your intraop imaging, but to try to prevent intraoperative fracture when you're trying to impact that graft?
Yeah, so it's, you know, I'll be honest with you, it's been a little bit of an evolution, and that's why I wanted Michael Taunton to comment on this, because I've learned a lot from him and his group about this, whereas, you know, the first time I did it, it was, you know, put a little skinny stem down there, put my cement restrictor, put a little bit of bone around there. And what I do is I take a femoral head, so a frozen femoral head from our bone bank, we thaw it and put it through the spine mill, which really grinds it up into these nice kind of, almost kind of like a snowflake consistency type of bone that's really easy to pack around there. Some people will add in some, you know, vancomycin powder to it to get a little bit of antibiotic delivery. But you can see here, and this is one of the earlier cases that I did it in, I had this stem down there. Right. So I had a Bux restrictor. I put a trial stem down there that was a little bit smaller than what we were going to utilize. And then I didn't actually dump this whole thing down there. That was just really to show the graft. And then tried to find these instruments, these kind of tamps, if you will, where I could tamp around the stem to try and pack, you know, the bone around there. And kind of full disclosure, we did it the first time that I pulled the stem out and all the graft came out with it. And we had to put it back down and re-tamp it down again. And it was, you know, we ended up getting a good mantle, but it was a lot of different, you know, back and forth. And then more recently, I've seen, you know, Michael, one of your partners, Kevin Perry and Matt Adell and those guys talk about some of the refinements in the technique, which is putting your Bux restrictor down, leaving the handle on, loosely packing some graft around there, and then taking one of the stems on a reamer, starting with the smallest size and gradually reaming into that and kind of dilating up that central diameter. And what that does is it just creates this hoop stress and just pushes all that bone graft out into the metatarsus and really impacts it in there really tightly. And have kind of switched over to doing, you know, that. And you can see even in this, you know, even in this post-operative x-ray with doing it with my kind of novice ability to do it early on and learning, you know, how to do it as you went along, it's really pretty impressive, this kind of reconstitution of that packed cancellous bone into the cement. But and there's kind of the lateral view of it as well. But Michael, wanted to kind of get your thoughts a little bit about some of the evolution of this you know, technique that y'all described and reported on as well.
Yeah, I actually just saw a patient of mine back that's 8 years follow-up that I did this on. And I will say it's a much more impressive technique on the femoral side than the tibia, because, you know, particularly if you have somebody that's has this really capacious distal femur from prior cement removal, particularly in, you know, let's say they've had a revision and then they've had a two stage and you come back and there's just this huge distal femur that's still got good condyles, but, you know, has this big hole. So it works, you know, I think that's where you really see the most impressive reconstitution of bone with time. But for both the tibial and the femoral side, if you're pulling out a cemented stem and that distal tip of cement stays, you can use that as your restrictor. If you've got something solid that you can impact, you can bone graft against, cement's going to be a lot better than a new cement restrictor. So I'll even leave that cement and then push the new cement restrictor up against it, leaving that our cement restrictors come on a really thin metal rod. It's not a disposable. I put that up there. And then Yeah, put in just a very little bone graft at a time. I usually, you know, use a square tip impactor or a round impactor, or sometimes the cement removal things will have something that's a little bit thicker on the end that you can use to pack in. So I think starting to pack against that small rod is usually the thing that really allows you to get the most bone in at the first. And then I think depending on what system you're using, how to, you know, then continue to impact the bone can be different. There's a couple of different knee systems that you can actually turn stem trials into a reamer. So, you know, if you find that you have one of those systems that have a smooth stem trial that can be chucked onto a power, that works really nice. But how I've done it for a long time is by using just standard reamers on reverse. So instead of grabbing at the bone, they're just reverse screwing themselves in. And I find that those impact the bone pretty good if you've already got it packed, pretty nicely. Adding a little bit of bone as you go to help further compress the bone. It's impressive how much bone that you can get in. One thing I would say is you want to make sure that you go back and reprep your cone or reserve using your prepping your cone till later, just so that you're not, compromising your cone fixation. You don't really want dead bone graft between your cone and your metaphysis.
Yeah, good point. And we'll put the cone in and mark it to make sure you're not getting a bunch of, you know, of that bone packed up in and around the cone. Cause you really, as you show here, in this picture, you still want to have that metaphyseal, right? That metaphyseal area where you're going to get good cone to host bone contact in the metaphysis. So definitely a little bit of learning curve associated, you know, with it. Certainly have become a little bit more efficient with it, with a lot of those, tips and tricks that you just talked about. And, you know, preliminary results on this have been very good and very encouraging. Obviously, this patient's, you know, only about 7 months out now. So I've only seen her maybe about twice postoperatively. She has been, you know, we let her weight bearers tolerated, let her range, you know, her knee right away, didn't restrict her at all. And at least early term, she's had, you know, fairly good resolution of her pain, you know, prior to that. So any other comments or thoughts from the panel before we wrap things up? Great. Well, you all have been wonderful. And I'm really excited to have each of you join us as faculty for the IOEN Vail Arthroplasty course. Again, it's January 12th through the 14th. Thanks to OrthoBullets for allowing us to do this Coin Flips and Controversies webinar. This will be posted on the website. There'll be links to the meeting where you can go and learn more about it. You can register for the meeting as well. We're going to have a pre-course just the night before the meeting that's going to focus on private equity. We're going to have special breakout sessions for your physician assistant. So if you register for the meeting, your physician assistant can attend for free and hopefully get some additional educational content in there. It's a great venue to have a meeting in Vail, Colorado, get a little bit of skiing during the breaks during the meeting for the day, and also be able to associate with incredible faculty like Dr. Long, Dr. Taunton, and Dr. Cohen Rosenblum. So really excited to hopefully have you all join there. Hope you've enjoyed the webinar tonight. Thanks again to the faculty and OrthoBullets for allowing us to put this on.